7. On all sides of him, meters and controls. The central panel glowed with data. Parsons seated himself on one of two stools facing the panel. In an ashtray, he saw a smoldering cigarette butt. Only a few minutes ago, the two men had hurried out of here, across to the prison ship. Now they were dead, and now he was here in their place. He thought, am I much better off? The control panel hummed. Dials changed slightly. The man had said, we moved the ship back in time. How far in time? But also it must travel in space. It goes to both dimensions. Examining the controls, he wondered, which operates which? He could make out a division on the board, two hemispheres. Somebody was trying to reach me, he realized. They brought me forward through time, hundreds of years, from my society to theirs, for some purpose. Will I ever know the purpose? At least I saw them face to face, if only for a moment. Good God, he thought. I'm lost in space, and I'm lost in time, in both dimensions. Above the hum of the panel, he detected an intermittent crackle of static. Now he located the cloth grill of a speaker. A communication system? But connected to what? Reaching out, he experimentally turned a knob. Nothing appreciable changed. He pressed a button near the edge of the board. All the dials changed. Around him, the ship trembled. The muffled concussion of jets shook him. We're moving, he thought. Hands swept out clock faces. Counters vanished. No numbers at all showed. A red light winked on, and at once the dials slowed. Some safety mechanism had come on. The view screen over the controls showed stars, but now one bright dot had become larger. He saw in its color a clear tint of red. A planet. Mars? Taking a deep, unsteady breath, he once again began experimenting with the controls. Below him, a parched red plain stretched out. He did not recognize it. Far to the right, mountains. Cautiously, he tried adjustments. The ship dropped sharply. He managed to steady it until it hung above the sun-cracked land. Corrosion. He saw limitless furrows gouged into the baked clay. Nothing moved. No life. After many failures, he managed to land the ship. With care, he unbolted the door. An acrid wind billowed into the ship and around him. He sniffed the smell of age and erosion. But the air, thin and weak, brought a faint trickle of warmth. Now Parsons stepped out onto the crumbling sand. His feet sank, and he stumbled. For the first time in his life, he was standing on another planet. Scanning the sky, he made out dim clouds on the horizon. Did he see a bird among them? Black speck that disappeared? The silence frightened him. He began to walk. Beneath his feet, stones broke apart and puffed into particles. No water. Bending, he picked up a handful of sand, rough against his skin. To his right, a heap of slag and boulders. There in the cold shadows, gray lichens that seemed no more than stains on the rock. He climbed the largest of the boulders. Far off, he saw what might have been an artificial construction, the remains of some massive trench cut deep into the desert. So he went that way. He thought, I'd better not lose sight of the ship. While he walked, he saw his second sign of life. On his wrist, a fly. It danced off and disappeared. Most noxious of all pests, and yet preferable to the dead wastes. This meager life form awesome and tragic in this context. Yet surely if a fly could survive, there had to be organic matter. Possibly on some other part of the planet, a settlement of some kind, the prison colonies, unless he had arrived long before or long after, once he had mastered the controls of the ship. In the distance, something sparkled. He started in that direction. At last, he came close enough to make out the sight of an unwrite slab. A marker? Breathless, he went up a slope, sliding in the loose sand. In the weak, ruddy sunlight, he saw before him a granite block set in the sand. Green patina covered it, almost obscuring that which had flashed. A metal plate bolted to the center. On the plate, writing. Engraved deep into the metal at one time, but now scoured almost smooth. Squatting down, he tried to read. Most of it was obliterated or illegible, but at the top, in larger letters, a word that could still be read. Parsons. His own name. Coincidence? He stared at it, unbelieving. Then, pulling off his shirt, he began rubbing away the accumulation of sand and grime. Before his name, another word. Jim. So there could be no doubt. This plaque set here in this wasteland had him as its topic. Into his mind came the mad, eerie notion that perhaps he had become some gigantic figure in history, known to all the planets, a legendary figure commemorated in this monument, like some god. But now, feverishly rubbing with his shirt, he managed to read the smaller engraving beneath. The plaque did not concern him. It was addressed to him. Foolishly, he sat in the sand, brushing at the letters. The plaque told him how to operate the ship, a manual of instruction. Each sentence was repeated, apparently to combat the ravages of time. He thought, they must have known that this block would stand here for centuries, perhaps thousands of years until I came along. The shadows on the far range of mountains had become longer. Overhead, the sun had begun to decline. The day was ending. Now the air had lost all warmth. He shivered. Gazing up at the sky, he saw a shape half lost in the haze. A gray disk sailed beyond the clouds. For a long time, he watched it, his heart beating heavily. A moon crossing the face of this world, much closer than the moon he knew, but perhaps its greater size was due to Mars being so much smaller. Shading his eyes against the long rays of the sun, he studied the face of this moon, the worn surface. The moon was Luna. That had not changed. The pattern on its visible side remained the same. This was not Mars. It was Earth. Here he stood on his own planet, on the dying ancient Earth, the waterless last age. It had, like Mars before it, ended in drought and weariness, with only black sand flies and lichens and rock. Probably it had been like this a long time, long enough to eradicate most of the remains of the human civilization that once existed. Only this plaque, erected by time travelers like himself, persons in search of him, tracking him down to reestablish the contact that had been lost. They had possibly put up many of these markers here and there. His name, the final written words. To survive, man, when everything else had gone. At sunset, he returned to the ship. Before entering it, he paused, taking a last look behind him. Better this, the night falling, obscuring the plain. He could imagine animals stirring, night insects appearing. Finally, he shut the lock. He snapped on lights. The cabin of the ship filled with pale white, and the control panel glowed red. Overhead, the loudspeaker crackled faintly to itself, the semblance, at least, of something alive. And on the threshold, a creature that had crawled into the ship during his absence, a hard-to-kill form of life, an earwig. He thought, that may survive everything else, the last to die. He watched this particular earwig crawl under a storage cupboard. A few will probably still survive, he reflected, when the plaque with my name on it has crumbled to dust. Seated at the controls, he selected the keys which the instructions had described. Then, in the combination given him, he punched out the tape and started the transport feeding. Dials changed. Now he had turned control over to them, the people who wanted him. He sat passive as the odd shudder again reached him and, on the viewing screen, the nocturnal scene jumped. Daylight returned, and after a time, hues of green and blue to replace the parched red. Earth reborn, he thought somberly. The desert made fertile once more. Faster and faster the scenes blurred, altered, thousands of years passing backward, no doubt millions. He could scarcely grasp it. In his attempts to operate the ship, He had run out the string entirely. He had gone into the future as far as the ship was capable of carrying him. Abruptly, the dials ceased their motion. I'm back, Parsons thought. Reaching out his hand, he touched a switch on the panel. The machinery shut off. He rose and walked to the door of the ship. For a moment he hesitated, and then he unbolted the door and pushed it wide. A man and woman faced him. Each held a gun pointed at him. He caught a glimpse of a lush green landscape, trees and a building, flowers. The man said, Parsons? Golden hot sunlight streamed down. Yes, he said. Welcome, the woman said in a husky, throaty voice. But the guns did not lower. Come out of the ship, doctor, the woman said. He did so. You found one of those markers? The man said. The instructions sent ahead for you? Parsons said. Apparently it had been up a long time. Going by him, the woman entered the ship. She inspected the meter readings on the panel.
A very long time, she said.
To her companion, she said,
Helmar, he went all the way.
You're lucky it was still usable, the man said. Are you going to keep the guns pointed at me? Parsons said. The woman came to the doorway behind him and said over his shoulder,
I don't see any shoe posts. I think it's all right.
She had put her gun away already, and now the man did so too. The man put his hand out. He and Parsons shook.
Do women shake hands too?
The woman asked, extending her hand.
I hope this doesn't violate a custom of your period.
The man, Helmar, said, How did the far future strike you?
I couldn't take it, Parsons said.
It's quite depressing, Helmar said. But remember, it'll be a long time coming, and gradual, and by that time there'll be planets inhabited. Both he and the woman regarded him with expressions of deep emotion, and he too felt profoundly moved.
Care for a drink, doctor? The woman asked.
No, he said. Thanks. He saw bees at work in nearby vines, and further along a row of cypress trees. The man and woman followed after him as he walked in the direction of the trees. Halfway there, he halted, taking in deep lungs full of air. The pollen-laden air of midsummer, the odors of growing things.
Time travel works erratically, the woman said. At least for us. We've had bad luck striving for exactitude. I'm sorry.
That's all right, Parsons said. Now he surveyed the man and woman, aware of them more clearly. The woman was beautiful even beyond what he had already seen in this world of youth and robust bodies. This woman was different, copper-colored skin that shone in the midday sun, the familiar flat cheekbones and dark eyes, but a different kind of nose, stronger. All her features had an emphatic quality, new to his experience. And she was older, perhaps in her middle 30s. A powerfully built creature with cascades of black hair, a heavy torrent all the way down her shoulders to her waist. On the front of her robe, lifted high by her breasts, was a herald, an intricate design woven into the rich fabric that rose and fell with the motion of her breathing. A wolf's head. You're Loris, Parsons said.
That's right, the woman answered.
He could see why she had become the Mother Superior of the Society, why her contribution to the Soul Cube was of supreme importance. He could see it in her eyes, in the firm lines of her body, her wide forehead. Beside her, the man shared some of her characteristics, the same coppery skin, the starkly etched nose, the mass of black hair, but with subtle, crucial differences. A mere mortal, Parsons thought, yet even so impressive. Two fine and handsome individuals, returning his gaze with intelligence and sympathy, alert to his needs. A high, emphatic order, he decided. Their dark eyes had a depth to which he felt his own psyche respond. The strength of their personalities forced his, too, to rise to a higher level of cognition. To him, Helmar said, Let's go inside. He indicated the gray stone building nearby. It's cooler,
and we can sit down. As they walked up the path, Loris said, and more private. A collie, wagging its great tail, approached them, its elongated muzzle raised. Helmar paused to thump the dog. As they turned the corner of the building, Parsons saw descending terraces, a well-tended garden that merged with trees and wilder shrubs.
We're quite secluded here, Loris said. This is our lodge. It dates back 300 years.
In the center of an open field, Parsons saw a second time travel ship and several men at work on it.
You may be interested in this, Loris said.
Leading the way, she brought Parsons over to the ship. There she took a smooth, shiny sphere from one of the technicians. The sphere, the size of a grapefruit, lifted of its own accord from her hands. She caught hold of it at once.
It's all set to go, she said. We're in the process of taking these into the future.
She pointed. The ship had been filled with these spheres. Helmar said, I presume by the time you came onto it, the thing was rather shabby looking.
Parsons took the sphere from Loris. I don't recognize it, he said, examining it.
Helmar and Loris exchanged glances.
These are the markers, Loris said. One of these contacted you in the far future.
These transmit for hundreds of miles, Helmar said. To your ship's radio. They both stared at him. Didn't you get your instructions through the loudspeaker? Didn't you hear one of these telling you how to operate the ship to bring it back here?
No, Parsons said. I found a granite monument with a metal plaque. The instructions were engraved in the metal.
Silence.
At last, Loris said quietly,
We know nothing about that. We constructed no such device. And it gave you instruction?
Helmar said, For operating our time ship?
Yes, Parsons said. And it was addressed to me. It had my name on it.
Helmar said, We've sent out hundreds of these markers. You never encountered one.
No,
Parsons said. The man and woman had lost their air of confidence, and Parsons, too, wondered the same thing. What had become of these spheres? And if these people hadn't erected the plaque, then who had?